Hey, hello everyone. We're broadcasting live. November 30th, 2015. Today is Dhammapada, so we aren't broadcasting the video yet. We will stick with audio. until after the Dhammapada, and then we'll also turn on the video. But for now, going to do a recording. Test. Okay, we're good. Hello and welcome back to our study of the Dhammapada. Today we continue on with verse 114, which reads as follows. Yo cha vasasatang jive apasang amatang padang Ekahang jivitang seyo pasato amatang padang. Which again is very similar to the verses that we've been looking at. It means better than to live 100 years not seeing the path to the deathless. Better it is to live one day seeing the path to the deathless. So this verse was taught in response to the story of Kisa Gotami. Kisa Gotami was, there's some idea that she was a relative of the Buddha, though I'm not sure, because she comes up in an earlier story of when Siddhartha was going forth. In one of the commentaries, I think. One of the other commentaries. But at any rate, we have Kisa means thin, so she was known as Thin Gotami, which apparently is a problem. Was a problem at the time. The measure of beauty at the time would have been plumpness and a nice full belly, to be able to do belly dancing. It was a big thing. So thin people, thin women were not attractive, probably not thin men either. And so she had trouble getting a husband. But finally there was some very, very strange thing that allowed her to get a husband, and I'm not really sure how we should interpret the story. It doesn't have anything to do with the story, so I'm not going to go into detail. But something about, ridiculous, about gold or... I don't really get it, so I'm not gonna try and relate it. But suffice to say, she was seen as being somehow good luck, because she was able to see charcoal as gold or something like that. I don't get it. She finally got a husband, is the point, and a big deal for her was having a child, and so she became pregnant, and that this was a really big deal for her. She was very keen to be a mother, and after 10 months of pregnancy, she gave birth to a son, and this was such a joy to her. Well, going through labor was not a chore. She was very keen for this to occur, as I would say most people would be, having carried a child around for 10 months. You would grow rather fond and attached to this being that's growing inside of you. And so once it was born, she was very much attached to this son. Very much in love with this, with her child. And he lived his first year growing up as children do, but at around the time he learned to walk, he contracted a sickness, and because medicine was at an unadvanced stage back then, he quickly died. And suffice to say, Kisa Gotami was devastated because this son of hers was pretty much her whole world. At the same time, she seems to have led a rather sheltered life because she had never seen death before and didn't really understand what death meant. And as a result, she picked up her dead son when they tried to burn his body. She wouldn't let them, and she picked him up and carried him on her hip and went off to find a doctor, someone to cure her son. And so she went from house to house trying to find someone who would have medicine who could cure her son. There must be a way to bring him back. It was she had no concept of death, of how it's final. And so, like any mother would do anything to find a cure if there were some way. And everyone turned her away, cursing her and ridiculing her and calling her rightfully crazy or foolish. But she didn't listen. She wouldn't listen. And she stubbornly refused to accept the fact that death is a one-way trip. And that in fact what she was carrying around wasn't actually her son. It was just the worn-out skin. Worn out, like a worn out snake skin. It was the leftover. Until finally, there happened to be a rather wise person who heard her asking again and again for medicine and correctly deduced that this was just a matter of not understanding death. And so he realized she needed someone to explain to her, to help her to understand, and to gently and wisely find a way to lead her. Because it's not that people hadn't tried. It seems that people had been trying to explain to her, you know, death is one way, but she wouldn't listen to them. She was very, very difficult to teach. You know, it seemed quite impossible to get through to her. And so this man said, well, you know, I don't know of any medicine that can heal your child, but I know someone and he knows the cure. And she was elated, ecstatic. She said, who could that be? She said, oh, he lives in, see, they use very, very archaic language in these stories, so I fall into it. Thou, thee, use all these words. In Jetavana, in Jeta's grove, go outside of the city and into the forest, and there's the forest of Jeta, go there. And that's where this doctor is residing. And so she immediately got up, thank you, said thank you, and went off on her way to find this person who could heal her son and restore meaning to her life. You know? Because for her, meaning was her whole attention, you know, how attached we can become to be, especially people, but to anything, really. And so she went to Jetavana and met with this doctor who, of course, was our beloved teacher and leader, the Buddha. And she asked him, she said, look, I've heard people tell me that you have a way to cure my child. Is this true? Could it be possible that you have some medicine? And he said, well, I know, yeah, I have the cure. And she says, what is it? What is the cure? He said, well, you have to bring to me some mustard seed. And she said, mustard seed, well, that's easy. Where And is it like special or some special mustard seed? It can't be just that. What sort of mustard seed do you want me to get? He said, well, no, just any old mustard seed will do, but you have to get me the mustard seed from a house where no one has ever died. No son or daughter has ever died. And she said, oh, well, that's fine. I'll go and do that right away. And so she wandered around from house to house, but everyone she talked to, they all had mustard seed. It was a common spice in India, still is. But there was no house where no one had died, you see. Everyone was somebody's son or daughter, and everyone's son or daughter, in every house, somebody's son or daughter, of course, had died. And especially with medicine and unable to cure very simple sicknesses, death would have been a common thing. You know, and they would say most people die, you know, just from miscarriage alone. Apparently, this is one of the arguments against God, is that a woman's pelvic bone there's something to do, something about the pelvic region is the wrong size, and it's not really meant for childbirth, or it's that the human head has grown too big, because childbirth shouldn't really happen. It's not really where the body isn't really made for childbirth, you know. Even though it is kind of made for childbirth, it's a very, very poorly built system. So the head is too big, and oftentimes requires a cesarean section, or else both the mother and the child could die. So back when they didn't have this, death in childbirth was common, you know. And even when born, stillbirth, this was common. Miscarriage, common. Birth of a child, you know, under 5 years old would have been common, with all the sicknesses and children's susceptibility to disease. So, death is everywhere. Death takes us all. The death, we live in the realm of death, the Buddha said, because we're all, it's like we are on death row, just waiting for our sentence. Of course, we've come to accept it, and we think of it as natural, but we are a lot like prisoners on death row, just waiting for our turn. And in fact, no one knows when their turn is going to be. We haven't been told when the execution is. We haven't even been told what sort of execution it's going to be. Could be slow, could be quick, could be torturous. You know, it's not death by lethal injection, not most likely. Not for most of us. For many of us, it's going to be terribly painful, fearsome. We're like prisoners in a dungeon waiting to be beheaded, or worse. The realm of the deathless is where we live. Not to be a total downer. But every house she went to would say this, and so she would have accepted their mustard seed, and she'd have to give it back to them and say, no, this mustard seed won't do. And from house to house, and sometimes it was fresh in people's minds, and so they would be sad, and maybe even cry. And she saw this sadness reflected in other people, and it really opened her eyes. And so this was the way of teaching her, without actually having to tell her, without trying to argue with her, was to see that this was a fruitless, a hopeless task. And slowly, this corpse on her at her side lost its attraction, lost its appeal, and she began to see it for what it was. It's just an empty husk. She started to see that death is just really a part of life. It is natural. Not a good thing, but certainly natural. And so, time after time, going to house after house, she eventually lost all of her attachment to this quest. and she looked down at the corpse. And she made a decision, went into the forest and dug a grave and buried her child, or placed the child in the forest, maybe, probably didn't bury it. Just laid it down in the forest. And then she went to the Buddha and bowed down to him and paid respect, and he said, "Oh, so did you get the mustard seed?" And she said, "No, I didn't. In every village, the dead are far greater than the living." And the Buddha said, "Indeed, it was foolish of you to think that only you have lost, to think that death has only come to you. All beings are subject to death." And he said, "The prince of death, like a raging torrent, sweeps away into the sea of ruin all living beings. Still are their longings unfulfilled." And then he again taught a verse that comes in a later chapter, 287. But we'll get to that later, so I'm not going to recite that. And when, as he taught her this, she, and based on just this ordeal that she'd been through, and then the teaching of the Buddha, she was actually able then and there to apply it and to become a Sotapanna through his teachings, which is quite remarkable. And as a result, she requested to become a bhikkhuni. And she became a bhikkhuni and fulfilled her duties and practiced meditation. And then the story goes that one day, every 2 weeks they'd have there's a gathering on the full moon and the empty moon. All the monks gather together. And so if the gathering is done at night, which in some monasteries it is, you have to light a lamp. So they would go and put the oil in the wick and light the lamp. And one day it was her turn to do this. And so she went and she lit the lamp. And of course she had been meditating. And so she stood there watching this flame flicker. And she saw the different flames come up from the lamp. And some flames would last a while, and some would flicker out. And she watched this arising and ceasing. And because she was so in tune with this aspect of cessation and birth, you know, true birth and death of every moment, it really hit her that that's really how our lives are. And she said, "It's like our lives are just like these flames. We come into existence and poof, when we're gone, that's it. There's no getting the flame back once it's gone." And the Buddha got a sense of this and came to see her, as with the last story. And that's when he taught her this verse. He said, "Even as it is with these flames, so also it is with living beings here in the world. Some flare up, while others flicker out. They only that have reached Nibbana are no more seen. So our lives are like a flame. We burn and then out. And then we come back again and again. If the flame is still lit, if the wick is still lit, the flame will come back again and again. And it fades out, comes back. So birth and death, incessant. But when you blow out, when the fire gets blown out, then there's no more flame." And so then he teaches the death lesson. So this is the idea that this verse is appropriate because it talks about death. It's appropriate because the story is all about death. So the key here was this realization of the prevalence and the ubiquitousness of death. That death is everywhere for everyone. That we live in the realm of death. And so the Buddha taught specifically about the deathless. Because Nibbana or freedom or enlightenment, this is the deathless, because you never come back. You don't flicker up and die out. There's no more flame. You become free. So this is how this relates to our practice. This really relates to the ultimate goal. And for many people, it's kind of a foreign concept. I think many people practice meditation without much concept of Nibbana. even without much desire for it, because it goes so contrary to our desires, right? We can see how some things are causing us suffering, and we do wish to be free from suffering. But it's a whole other thing to take it to its extreme, to take it to its logical conclusion, though, and think about complete cessation. If I cease, then what's left of all the things that I love and enjoy? So how this relates directly to our practice, it's something that you have to, it's on the horizon, right? But it's the logical outcome. It's not like it's something you fall into. It's something that eventually a person comes to. You know, because there is, as long as we have desire for something, we're going to be reborn again and again and again and again. There's no question there. It's just that once you start to look clearly, and it may take lifetimes to do so, but eventually you start to become disenchanted. You see that it's the same thing again and again, and it's not really as pleasant or as comfortable or as happy as we think it's going to be. We just end up wanting more and more and more and just getting disappointed. We have to learn all these lessons about how we can't ever get what we want, and that's really unpleasant. We have to go through much unpleasantness. So eventually, you realize that life after life after life, it's not really all that it's cracked out to be. And I think if we looked at this life as just one in a string of countless lives, we'd come to see that, well, actually, you know, if I have to do this all again, you know, if the learning isn't cumulative and I'm going to forget all these lessons I've learned and have to start over, it's not really that great of a thing to do again and again. It's quite stressful and unpleasant. But again, as long as we cling, and as long as we desire it, as long as we're happy about being alive, there's no worry. We're still going to die. We're going to die again and again and again. It's only when we become free that we liberate ourselves from death as well. So that's the path of the deathless. Path to the deathless is to give up our attachments and our desires. Our attachments to our own life, our attachment to the lives of others, our attachment to becoming in general, to any kind of arising. This is very much what we're into in meditation, so it goes in stages. In the beginning, we're only interested in the arising of real suffering, you know, like pain and unpleasantness and our own immorality and that kind of thing. Once we do away with that, then it's only a matter of refining it, right? So that eventually we come to see that suffering is really much more refined than that, and it's in everything. And eventually we give up more and more, and we see more and more of our activities are based on greed and anger and delusion and arrogance and conceit and all that. So we give up more and more and more until eventually we're free. We give up everything. We let go of everything, and then we can fly away and never have to come back. So that's the Dhamma for tonight. It's the teaching on the deathless. One more verse. After this, we have one more verse that's very, very similar, and then we'll be finished with this chapter. But these are important stories. It's the story. This is a very well-known story of how Kesava Gotami found medicine for her dead son. Medicine to help her fix this problem of having a dead son. And she ended up fixing it by learning to let go, by learning to be more flexible, because her son went on his own journey. It's not like she's betraying his memory. She's just accepting reality that he was gone, and her path led elsewhere. So that's the Dhammapada for tonight. Thank you all for tuning in. Keep practicing. That's the Dhammapada portion. Now we can turn off some lights. Leave that one on, no? It looks okay. Turn off the camera. Stick my armpit in your face and start the broadcast. Okay. Good evening, YouTube. We are now broadcasting YouTube live, and we can link the Hangout to our chat. So if anybody wants to join the Hangout, come on and show their face. You're welcome to. Or if you want to hide behind the text, you can do so. So I have, do you remember how I was talking about, was I ranting on here about this, the Muslim group on campus? Maybe not on here. I told you guys about the, this interfaith cafe. Did I tell you about that?
Yes.
And how everyone, they didn't really seem all that interested in peace. It was more like our religion is great. And then, in follow-up to that, after Paris, the Muslim Association on campus has really aggressively sought to appease peoples improve the people's opinion of Islam. So today, after class, I was in the student center and I was meeting up with my friend and her friend, and because she had a breakdown, and so I was there to talk to her. But in the entryway, they've got all these tables for all the clubs, and I've seen in the big area, somehow they got these, they were able to put up all these banners, and one of the big banners is this big black banner with red lettering. Now, a black banner with red lettering saying, Islam and the West incompatible, or something like that. And then there is, Islam is about justice, about equality, and that's it. And so I've been complaining about it, saying that why isn't it about peace? And if they're trying to give a positive image, why are they using black and red? and why are they worried about Islam being compatible? I mean, the wording of it is really strange. It was my father. I was telling my father about this. They're not saying peace, and I felt like they weren't at this interfaith cafe. They also weren't. Not at the interfaith. There was a rally for Beirut because there was a bombing or there was something in Beirut and Paris. So, and this guy stood up, who I guess was a Muslim, and he was talking about Islam, and he never really said peace. It was like he was beating around the bush. And so I get the feeling these people aren't interested in peace exactly. And so this guy in the entryway, this guy said, can I take 10 seconds of your time? And I had no idea what he was. I didn't see his table or what he was holding. And I looked at them and I said, one. I was going to start counting. And then he starts talking. And then he pulls out this little thing, which is a smaller version that says, Islam and the West. And I started ranting at him. I said, look, you. This is not helping. And I said, why doesn't it say peace? And he said, oh, well, Islam means peace. Islam doesn't mean peace, I'm pretty sure. Islam means surrender, I think, right? The word. And I said, well, why doesn't it say that? Why are you concerned with Islam in the West? If it said Islam in the peace, I'd go. And he said, well, if you come, you'll feel very peaceful vibes. And I said, well, looking at that, I don't feel peaceful vibes. It's black and red. And he actually agreed with me. He said, yeah, well, that's true. And so I really gave him a piece of my mind, and I think I really got through to him, whether it's going to make any influence or not. But I'm not impressed, and I told him that. I said, you guys don't have your heads on straight. And I think it's the Christians as well, for the most part, don't have their head on straight, and people are not really interested in peace. And that's shameful on both sides. You know, if you want to improve the image of your religion, come out and say it. Don't be afraid to say it. My religion is about peace. I believe in peace, and that's it. You know, I denounce denounce any kind of violence. I think, but they don't. I think for the most part, they're happy about violence and they want violence. Well, maybe that's going too far, but they, there's. If someone wrongs you, you hurt them, that kind of thing. The eye for the eye and that kind of thing. So this thing says justice and equality. And I was thinking about that, you know, because justice doesn't do it for me, because everyone has their own idea of justice, right? If your justice is like the Old Testament, an eye for an eye, well, that makes everybody blind. In one eye. And equality as well. I mean, if your religion teaches horrible things, which I don't know, I mean, I think many of these religions, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, do, then, you know, equality is meaningless if everyone has to follow horrible teachings equally. I mean, I guess they're addressing the idea that women are unequal in most of these religions. I don't know about Christianity, I can't remember, but I'm pretty sure that in Judaism it's been pretty unequal in the texts, and pretty sure that in Islam it's the same. I don't know. Either way, I mean, equality, that's good in a sense, to not be prejudiced against people. My point is, they're missing the whole point. Here people have been violent and, you know, awful in the name of your religion, and all you want to say is that it's compatible with the West? I mean, who cares? Are you against these bombings? Are you against these shootings? What do they do? Now, are you against these atrocities or not? That's what we want to know. Do you believe that hurting people is good? And they're not addressing it. And then they put up these black and red signs, and you think these are terrorists. You know, who puts up a black and red sign? Death metal signs are black and red. It was the kind of colors that I would go for when I was heavy metal, listening to Ozzy Osbourne and going to Black Sabbath concerts. It's not peace. Oh, there's my rant for the day. But I felt like I'd done something, because I really felt I finally got a chance to talk to someone about this. I've just been shaking my head at these people. They have no idea. PR, they've got a bad PR person, that's for sure. Yeah. But I think it's more than that. I don't know. I'm really not impressed with Islam so far. I'm not impressed with many religions, actually. So we had a discussion about religion with Katya is her name. She said, "Would you say that all religions, or religions, have been the cause of most conflicts in the world?" We just got talking about it. Anyway, that was my story for today. Oh, and we meditated in the atrium. That's the other thing. Just a short meditation. There was only three of us. But it was nice. The atrium's a nice place. So we're going to do atrium on Monday. The gym on Wednesday. And the student center on Friday. So we'll have three meditations a week for the rest of the year, hopefully.
Nice.
And did I mention the book thing? Last night we talked about the books, right?
Yes, briefly, yes.
We're trying to figure it out. Everyone's all confused. I don't remember who did it last time, but I just assumed it would be easy. It's all, because the publisher certainly knows. If we can somehow get through to the publisher, he's ready to print them, I'm sure. As long as he's not dead. Everyone dies, he might be dead. But otherwise, it's just a matter of everyone's confused, wondering, oh, you want, send us it and we'll print it out. Like, no, it's already there. It just has to be printed. Is it color? Is it this cover? No, you don't understand. Don't ask me these questions. Just contact the publisher. He knows.
So it's a reprint, really.
Yeah, it's a reprint. It's like the third or fourth reprint. And just keep printing more.
That's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he's a Buddhist. He's a student of Giribhadgoda. Katukurunde Nyanananda and Dhammajivahamdra, I don't remember where he's from, but Dhammajiva and Jnanananda, these two monks. Really neat guy. Seems like it.
Monte, when you get the books back, if people want one, can they send a self-addressed stamped envelope or something to get one?
Yeah, that works for me. You send a self-addressed stamped envelope, I can send it back. It's not really necessary because you can download it, right?
Yes.
But if you want the nice shiny copy, I don't have one here, that you can also. Questions? Do we have any questions today?
We have questions.
Okay.
In the Western world and Western ancient studies, there are a number of people that study and even fluently speak the dead language, Latin. Are there any people today that still study Pali to the point that they can speak it? If so, how would one do this? Would you ever consider taking a large amount of time to do this?
We talked about it. In Burma, they do it. I think Burma's probably the only place left. Maybe Sri Lanka, but not really. Not really. But in Burma, they still do conversational Pali. And in Thailand, they've started to try. These monks who have studied in Burma have made textbooks. I've got one of the textbooks that's also in English. It's English, Thai, and Pali. And it's conversational Pali. It's really kind of neat, but it never got off the ground. I'd like to get some people who know Pali together and actually do this, learn it. The only time I really got close was many years ago. There was a Pali group, and I think it's still going. I'm not really involved, but it was what we did is we set up this like a wiki. It was just a page that we could all edit, and we would take turns writing sentences. So I would say something, and the next person would reply. And we were speaking in Pali, and we could correct each other's grammar, and we could ask questions about grammar and so on. But it never took off because I wasn't really all that good, but I was the only one who really had. And there weren't many people interested, but of the three or four people interested, I was the only one who could even come close to forming a sentence. So we need people who really know the language. But that would be something. It was really neat to do. Be able to type to each other in Pali to have a conversation. It's easier when you type because you've got more time to actually have to speak it. I mean, Ajahn Tong, whenever he meets Burmese people, he says something in Pali to them. And Sri Lankans as well, he's tried, but Sri Lankan monks, I brought a Sri Lankan monk to him, and the Sri Lankan monk had no idea what he was saying. In Sri Lanka, they don't really do it anymore. Some do, but it's not so common anymore.
I continually have this happen where I cannot seem to focus on one thing with noting. I will note rising, and then my attention will go to my feeling of sitting, so I'll say sitting, but then my attention will have gone elsewhere. So what do I do to stop focusing on noting and let myself just experience what happens and note when possible? Is this acceptable practice? Do you understand what I'm trying to say? I'll be on tomorrow to clarify if not. Thank you, Bhante.
Yeah, I mean, if it's many things distracting you, then you would say distracted or even overwhelmed is a common one. When you feel overwhelmed, you can say overwhelmed. There's nothing wrong with that per se, but you do want to try to come back to your base, back to the stomach, rather than jumping from object, from one to another. You know, you do one, and then if something interrupts it, you say that you acknowledge that. But when there's nothing, try to come back to the stomach to start over. I wouldn't worry too much about that. You're seeing impermanence, suffering, and non-self, so that's good. It helps you to let go.
How does one know when they are experiencing nibbana and not just filled with aversion to life's activities?
You don't know when you're experiencing nibbana. There's no knowing in nibbana. Don't worry about that. Don't worry about nibbana. It's not something you can miss. It's not something you can mistake for anything else.
I think we're all caught up with questions. Oh, I'm sorry. I read it wrong. I apologize. He meant nibbida, not nibbana. How does one know when they are experiencing nibbida and not just filled with aversion to life's activities? Uh-huh. My apologies.
Well, nibbida is not aversion. Nibbida is losing your desire. So when you find that you don't have desire for things that you used to desire, that's nibbida. When you look at things that you normally desire and you say it's just not worth it, that's nibbida. Ni means out or not. Bida, it comes from, what does it come from? I think from desire or something. It has something to do with your excitement. Nibida means not excitement, not excited. Vida, I don't know.
Any word on the project in Tampa, Bhante?
No word yet. Okay. But they said Monday or Tuesday.
So. Maybe tomorrow.
Okay. Good night then, everyone. Thank you for tuning in. Thanks, Robin, for your help.
Thank you, Bhante. Good night.